Mayor Anise Parker told Time magazine about female officers. What women never think is, can I wrestle this guy to the ground? She's more likely to control the situation with voice and presence than any kind of physical tool. Buchholz pointed out that policing is still a very physical job. But there are only two ways to deal with a situation as an officer, he pointed out, reason or use force. Women, he says, are simply better at reasoning than men. But having a gun is a force equalizer, and having a radio is a force multiplier. Bad guys can't outrun a radio. Because of that, he argued that law enforcement is a whole different ballgame from firefighting in that women bring distinct skills to the table and can be equipped so that they are on par with a 250-pound bad guy, with reinforcements almost always close by. The female propensity for communication instead of excessive force saves taxpayers money, too. The Tale of Two Genders study found that only 6% of legal fees paid in excessive force cases involved offenses by female officers, meaning that male officers cost somewhere between 2.5 and 5.5 times more than the average female officer in excessive force liability lawsuit payouts. In a piece making the case for more female officers to reduce police violence, New York Magazine cites the example of Los Angeles, which in one decade paid out $63.4 million in lawsuits for excessive force and other violent incidents involving male officers, compared to just $2.8 million for legal settlements involving female officers, none of which involved excessive force. In that same decade, according to Time, settlement costs for cases of male brutality were 23 times that for similar cases involving female police officers. Killings by male police were 43 times that by female police, and assault and battery by male officers was 32 times that by women. In a strange foray away from political correctness, New York Magazine chalked the difference up to sexual differences that can be seen as early as infancy, noting a 2007 study that found toddler boys are more likely than toddler girls to bite or kick, a finding, the author wrote, that makes you think that the male disposition to violence is not wholly a matter of socialization to traditional gender roles, or, more bluntly, acculturation to toxic masculinity. Even more astounding, there's evidence that humans aren't the only one with gender disparities in aggression, citing a study that points out, males are the more belligerent sex in virtually all mammalian species that biologists have studied. The differing propensities toward aggression and violence, the author says, may be in our very biology. When, God forbid, we allow ourselves to acknowledge sex difference, suddenly we see that men and women bring different things to the civic table. Different, but equally important contributions. As another writer put it, in Time magazine, women have a long history of social work and community outreach, and female police officers tend to excel at community building. Ever since women started serving on the police force, they have focused on community outreach. The first female police officers, Lola Baldwin in Portland, Oregon, in 1908, and Alice Stebbins in Los Angeles in 1910, were former social workers, and most early female officers dealt almost exclusively with women and children. Study after study shows that the tools of social work, an overwhelmingly female occupation, are critical in modern policing, and that women's softer skills may counter the escalation of conflicts. There are plenty who would call that statement a sexist reinforcement of gender stereotypes. And yet, the studies and numbers make it clear that female officers, on the whole, approach law enforcement differently from men in critical ways, just as, on the whole, we are not as strong as men and generally not going to be as well suited for some jobs, like running up 7 flights of stairs carrying a ladder and back down carrying a deadweight 200-pound man. To push first responder agencies into accepting unqualified women into these roles endangers both society and women, as well as affirming the notion that the male norm of brute strength is the ideal. Instead, we should be putting resources into identifying how women's unique capacities can benefit everyone. As Matthew Buchholz put it, you don't have to be kicking in a door to be deemed critical. Chapter 6. Valley of the Dolls. Humanity requires both men and women, and we are equally important and need one another. Beyoncé Knowles Carter. When R&B singer John Legend and his wife, the model Chrissy Teigen, announced she was pregnant, they opened up about their fertility struggles. Not only had they used in vitro fertilization to conceive, they had used reproductive technology to choose their baby's sex. In an interview with People magazine, a grinning Teigen, pictured in a clingy white maternity dress noshing on a bowl of strawberries, said, "I've made this decision. Not only am I having a girl, but I picked the girl from her little embryo. I picked her and was like, let's put in the girl. I think I was most excited and allured by the fact that John would be the best father to a little girl. That excited me. It excited me to see just the thought of seeing him with a little girl. I think he deserves a little girl. I think he deserves that bond. A boy will come along. We'll get there too, so it's not like we really have to pick. But he definitely is very lucky to have a little girl. And this girl is going to be so completely lucky to have John as her papa. It's crazy." As People goes on to explain, Teigen, 30, thinks that something magical happens to guys when they become a dad to a daughter. How soft they get, how mushy and excited they get. It's so cute, she says. Sex selection is considered a form of eugenics and condemned by international entities such as the United Nations and the World Health Organization, which points out that the practice raises serious moral, legal, and social issues. It results, the WHO says, in the distortion of the natural sex ratio leading to a gender imbalance and reinforces discriminatory and sexist stereotypes towards women by devaluing females. Sex selection through abortion has also been used to eliminate more than 100 million girls from the world, but it's still legal in a few countries like Thailand and the United States. Never mind all that, though. Teigen got her fair share of criticism about the ethics of her choice, but most people hardly noticed that she accidentally affirmed the gender binary in daring to acknowledge the differences between the sexes that mean mothers and fathers have different relationships with their daughters and their sons. And nobody complained about Chrissy Teigen and John Legend prematurely assigning their child a gender instead of letting the child choose a gender for herself. The Kate Effect. When the royal couple, Prince William and Duchess Kate, had their second baby, their announcement became a flashpoint in the gender debate. An official Twitter account for the royal family sent out the following notice: "Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cambridge was safely delivered of a daughter at 8:34 a.m. The public response to the birth of Princess Charlotte was primarily one of jubilation, but partially one of quasi-satire about the audacity of identifying the baby by her sex. One viral tweet read, "Please stop calling the hashtag royal baby a girl. We don't know what the baby's gender is until it is old enough to decide for itself." One Reddit post read, "Remember to stop gendering and speciating the royal baby. Z may be a girl, but could also be a boy. For all we know, Z is a demi-boy, or may not even be a baby but a fox, a ghost, or a sycamore. It is up to Z to decide this, not us." The poster was appropriately named Dare to be Sane. It was hard to tell satire from seriousness when the folks at Slate were calling the identification of newborns by sex child abuse, and a pregnant woman in my own Facebook feed, a fellow graduate of Tufts, wrote that same week of taking offense when someone asked her if she was having a boy or a girl, because in her words, a fetus can't have a gender. The royal couple's fetus, like Teigen and Legend's, most certainly had a sex, though. Both were girls. And despite the mini-gender debate that followed the birth of Princess Charlotte, the fact is that a major part of the appeal of the royal couple is their striking sexual difference and complementarity. Prince William is almost always seen in crisp military uniform or a neatly tailored suit. Duchess Kate is one of the most feminine and fashionable figures in the world. Their wedding was one of the most watched events in world history, with tens of millions of viewers on television and another 72 million on YouTube in 188 countries. As the official blog for YouTube wrote of its royal wedding viewers, "You old romantics, you." The wedding was Cinderella-esque, she in a traditional lace gown reminiscent of Grace Kelly and a tiara, he in full military regalia of a striking red hue. As they rode a carriage through the streets, he frequently held a white-gloved hand in salute as she respectfully and demurely lowered her eyes. According to YouTube, their highly anticipated kiss on the palace balcony resulted in an additional 10,000 viewing requests per second on top of the 101 million viewers already tuned in. People are starved for traditional romance, and the royal couple just keeps delivering it. In the 6 years since their wedding, Kate in particular has become a media focal point, not just because of her fashion sense, but because of how she's blossomed very naturally into her role as wife and mother. She is considered to be the most talked about woman in the world, and a YouGov survey found that 98% of respondents hold a positive view of her. But not everyone has something nice to say about her. Indeed, Kate Middleton has become the subject of a feminist tug-of-war. The argument is over whether she deserves admiration, considering the traditional trajectory of her life. Germaine Greer, dubbed the Queen of British Feminist Thinking in a cover story on The Duchess for Newsweek, said, "Kate is not even allowed to decorate her own houses. Even the wives of the American presidents get to do that. The whole thing is a mad anachronism. The firm tell us that the firstborn will now become the monarch regardless of sex. Well, big effing deal. Kate is not allowed to have an interest in modern culture, even in art, to collect, to attend openings. She is made to appear absolutely anodyne. She cannot do or say anything spontaneous. She has learned what she has to do and say and how to do and say it in the approved way. Spontaneity will get her in trouble." In a 2013 podcast for the London Review of Books, author Hilary Mantel, another feminist, she has said, "I think for a woman to say, 'I'm not a feminist,' is like a lamb joining the slaughterer's guild. It's just empty-headed and stupid," and admitted to fantasizing about killing Margaret Thatcher, whom she described as a psychological transvestite, called Middleton a jointed doll on which certain rags are hung. In those days before her first pregnancy, she was a shop window mannequin with no personality of her own, entirely defined by what she wore. These days she is a mother-to-be and draped in another set of threadbare attributions. Once she gets over being sick, the press will find that she is radiant. They will find that this young woman's life until now was nothing, her only point and purpose being to give birth. Mantel calls Middleton machine-made, with a perfect plastic smile and the spindles of her limbs hand-turned and gloss-varnished. But second-wave feminist hate hasn't stifled the Duchess's appeal, even among a rising generation of self-styled feminists. As Charlotte Alter wrote for Time, "I love Kate against all the odds. I am a feminist. She is a poster child for marriage and motherhood. I work, she waves. I love talking, she hates talking. You might call us star-crossed." As implausible as it seems for an empowered American millennial woman to love Kate, I'm not alone. The feminist blog Jezebel posts regular updates on Princess Shinylock's every move. Breathless coverage of the royal wedding and birth dominated U.S. news outlets. There are many theories about why we love Kate. None explain why some modern American girls are mesmerized by a woman who stands for everything we disavow: beauty as value, marriage as achievement, procreation as purpose. Might it be that we love her because she embodies a certain womanly paradigm, one that today's women are taught to hate and deny, and she does so without the slightest suggestion of misgivings? Because she represents feminine grace, maternal instincts, elegance, poise, and intelligence, and appears to be adored by a handsome man who also happens to be a prince all the while. She is a poster child, a particularly glamorous one at that, for marriage and motherhood, two things that, study after study finds, women very much want, Men, too, still desire marriage and fatherhood. 85% of female college students in the U.S. still want to get married by 30. The Duchess tied the knot at age 29, and all but a very small slice of the population still want to have children. But never mind all that, we aren't supposed to like Kate, because, as Newsweek's Ed Docs put it, Kate's story thus far has been the very antithesis of a feminist narrative, quite literally that old pernicious fairy tale, wait for a prince, become a princess, and then cede all authority to the man while assuming the subservient role of mother and wife. Memo to my fellow female adorers of Duchess Kate. We are backward betrayers of feminism and our own sex. Foam finger feminism. So what is pop culture's vision of the empowered woman? It's hardly an attractive alternative to all things Kate. As Charlotte Alter puts it, our own tawdry celebrities have to feign masturbation with a foam finger to get our attention. Or sit naked on a toilet eating cake for the entire world to see, as Hollywood's poster child for women's rights, Lena Dunham, infamously did in the opening sketch for the 2012 Emmy Awards. The creator of the HBO soft porn series Girls gets naked a lot, so often that there are articles devoted just to her nudity sessions. Lena Dunham has positioned herself as a feminist mentor of sorts for Hollywood's young starlets, but her credentials when it comes to empowering women are highly questionable. Her show Girls, when it came out, got an atypically candid and despondent review in the New York Times. One reason that Girls is unsettling is that it is an acerbic, deadpan reminder that human nature doesn't change. For all the talk of equality, sexual liberation, and independence, the love lives of these young women are not much more satisfying than those of their grandmothers. Their professional expectations are, if anything, even lower. And that is the baseline joke of Girls. Sex and the City served up romantic failure wrapped in the trappings of success. Girls offers romantic failure wrapped in the trappings of failure. Dunham made her name and fortune off of a show that almost revels in today's sexual objectification of women and their professional flounderings. Even so, she's been crowned the spokeswoman for my generation when it comes to gender. As Heather Wilhelm points out, Dunham has been dubbed the voice of a generation of women by Rolling Stone and the voice of a generation full stop by Harper's Bazaar. She is said by Vanity Fair to have captured her generation's story and has been called a generation's gutsy, ambitious voice by Time. In her own voice, Dunham said in an interview with Vanity Fair that feminism means, you believe you deserve all the same things that people who were born, not of your gender deserve. If you care about equality, it's really simple and hard to negate. That sounds benign enough, but she goes on to add, part of feminism is the freedom to let other women make choices you don't necessarily understand. Her first example, so while you may not want to walk out with, like, tape, like X's on your nipples and booty shorts, that may be the strong feminist choice for another woman. And if you can't imagine yourself in her shoes, part of your job as a feminist is just to support her. Naturally, then, as Dunham explains, I have no feminist issue with the Kardashians. It's not my place to judge the Kardashians. It's my place to enjoy the beauty that they're bringing to the table. Dunham's feminist bona fides include telling a story about sexually abusing her sister, cracking an abortion joke about Kate Middleton's pregnancy, and dressing as a Planned Parenthood abortionist for Halloween. Planned Parenthood gave her a shout-out in return, calling her a tireless champion for women. Dunham returned the love by attending a Planned Parenthood gala clad in what Us Weekly called the world's most appropriate top, a sweater embroidered with a pink image of the female reproductive system. The magazine gushed, womb love. Lena Dunham spoke at the Planned Parenthood Champion of Choice event. The girl's creator and star donned the Girl Power Burgundy sweater by Rachel Antonoff, $218, though now sold out, teamed with a pleated leather skirt. She accessorized the ensemble with polka-dotted heels and an emerald statement necklace. She styled her hair into tousled waves and finished with a rose-hued lip. Dunham's anything-goes approach to women's empowerment demonstrates how feminism degenerates into aggressive, masculine raunch when untethered to any specific principle, and actually strips women of choice by requiring adherence to certain controversial beliefs as entry tickets to the club, which, as it turns out, is exceptionally small. According to Dunham, women saying, "I'm not a feminist," is my greatest pet peeve. So in Lena Dunham's world, women shouldn't really have a choice about being feminists, and their job as a feminist is to support any choice a woman makes, even if that includes posting naked selfies, as the likes of Kim Kardashian are wont to do. And Dunham's hostage-style feminism is purported to represent an entire generation. No wonder the overwhelming majority of Americans, women included, don't self-identify as feminist. In one poll conducted by Vox, only 18% of respondents considered themselves feminist. In Duchess Kate's kingdom, that number dips to a staggering 7%. Another poll found that less than one-fourth of American women accept the label feminist. Yet another revealed that nearly 50% reject the term, and of those women, half do so because they find modern feminism too extreme, and another quarter because they view it as too anti-man. That's what Taylor Swift thought, until she met Lena Dunham. In an interview with The Guardian, Swift says that she used to have the wrong impression of feminism. "As a teenager, I didn't understand that saying you're a feminist is just saying that you hope women and men will have equal rights and equal opportunities. What it seemed to me, the way it was phrased in culture, society, was that you hate men. For so long, it's been made to seem like something where you'd picket against the opposite sex." But then the singer-songwriter struck up a Twitter friendship with Dunham that quickly blossomed into a full-on feminist love fest and resulted in what Swift described as a feminist awakening. "Becoming friends with Lena, without her preaching to me, but just seeing why she believes what she believes, why she says what she says, why she stands for what she stands for, has made me realize that I've been taking a feminist stance without actually saying so." Swift came out as a feminist right in the middle of a Hollywood girl power burst that was entirely befuddling. The most prominent member of feminism's new pop culture faithful was Beyoncé, who made a hairpin turn away from being the sexy and soulful woman who had spoken candidly about sleeping with only one man, the man who put a ring on it, as she admonishes men to do for the women they love in one of her biggest hits, broken Twitter records, besting the death of Osama bin Laden at the 2011 MTV Video Music Awards when she stopped in the middle of a performance and tore off her jacket to reveal a baby bump, and basked in her new maternity, describing the sound of her baby's heartbeat on the sonogram as the most beautiful music I ever heard in my life. Ever so briefly, Beyoncé was a rare Hollywood star who was, as I described her for Acculturated, an incredibly talented, strong, and fearless woman who loves babies and marriage and isn't afraid to show it. Even President Obama had something to say about her role as a woman. "Beyoncé could not be a better role model for my girls because she carries herself with such class and poise and has so much talent." Sadly, it didn't last. Barely a year after Obama spoke those words, a mostly nude Beyoncé was gyrating on stage in her husband's lap in a performance for the 2014 Grammys. As Naomi Schaefer Riley wrote in a piece pointedly entitled, "Jay-Z, A Poor Excuse for a Husband," what do you call a man who stands there smiling and singing as his scantily clad wife straddles a chair and shakes her rear end for other men's titillation? Riley could also have asked, what do you call a woman who uses her platform to degrade herself sexually for money, attention, and fame? Not a feminist, surely. Nevertheless, Beyoncé became Hollywood's empowered Hollywood woman du jour with something to say about gender. As a contributor to the Shriver Report, a self-described nonpartisan initiative that raises awareness, ignites conversations, and inspires impact around the defining issues and fundamental changes facing modern women, Beyoncé wrote in early 2014, "We need to stop buying into the myth about gender equality. It isn't a reality yet." That same year, Beyoncé was on the cover of Time's 100 Most Influential People issue. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg, of feminist manifesto Lean In fame, penned the profile of Beyoncé, writing, "In the past year, Beyoncé has sold out the Mrs. Carter Show world tour while being a full-time mother. She raises her voice both on and off stage to urge women to be independent and lead." Sandberg cited some of Beyoncé's PG lyrics, but omitted others, such as, "He Monica Lewinsky'd all over my gown," from her album Partition. And she might have been less enthusiastic in her praise after Beyoncé's 15-minute MTV Video Music Awards performance a few months later. As The Federalist's Molly Hemingway detailed, that performance included a stage full of backup dancers in naked stripper costumes gyrating on strip poles, one of the most amazing collections of derrieres I have ever seen, songs about performing oral sex in the back of a limo, a song about having a guy tear that cherry out, complete with the word cherry in big letters as the backdrop, a song that tells women who don't respect Beyoncé sufficiently to bow down bitches, S&M themes, and intimate acquaintance with much of Bey's crotch. "The usual," Hemingway continued. "I mean, it wasn't totally usual in that Beyoncé's toddler child was in the audience to witness all this dry humping and simulated getting down, but other than that, your typical Beyoncé." Out with the old, somewhat more wholesome Beyoncé, in with the new feminist Beyoncé. However lamentable, her evolution embodied Hollywood's approach to sex and gender. The empowered woman is as hypersexualized as the raunchiest teenage male and can do whatever she wants, even celebrate sexual violence against women. Don't forget that it's your feminist job, as Lena Dunham put it, to respect any woman's strong feminist choice. Unless you are Sofia Vergara. Less than 24 hours after Beyoncé's striptease before the block letters Feminist, Bruce Rosenbloom, the chair of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, asked Modern Family star Sofia Vergara to stand on a rotating pedestal so that all could admire her famous curves as he gave a speech at the 2014 Emmys. Vergara was a lot more dressed than Beyoncé was at the VMAs, and she did little more than stand there. But because her performance involved a physical pedestal, feminists raked her over the coals for acquiescing to the whims of the patriarchy. The contrasting responses to Beyoncé's and Vergara's actions made it clear, in Hemingway's words, what an incoherent mess of double standards pop culture feminism has become. When Vergara was asked whether she considered herself a feminist, she didn't help her cause with the women she had vexed. Vergara spelled out plainly how many women see feminism as directly in conflict with being a woman. I'm in the middle ground. As a Latin woman, I love having a husband, someone to be there waiting for me, supporting me. I don't see anything bad with getting help from somebody that loves you and treats you well. That's an amazing job and a lot of effort to do it right. I think the beauty of a woman nowadays is that we can do everything. We have more options, and we should do everything we can. But why not have support and love? And if somebody can help you in any way, why not take the help? The Real Feminists of Hollywood. Hollywood's misogyny masked as feminism really became undeniable when, later that year, Emily Ratajkowski, the topless star of the music video of Robin Thicke's song Blurred Lines, hitched herself to the feminist bandwagon. She graced the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine, little more these days than a digest on how to sexually please a man, and was featured in an article with the headline, "I feel lucky that I can wear what I want, sleep with who I want, and dance how I want, and still be a feminist." The Daily Beast's Trisha Romano called Blurred Lines kind of rapey and pointed out that the music video, which helped propel the song to the top of the charts, was little more than three models, Emily Ratajkowski, Jesse Mbenge, and Elle Evans, wearing nothing but shoes and nude-hued thongs as they cavort and dance and flirt with Thicke, Pharrell, and T.I., who are all fully clothed, while occasional lines like, "Robin Thicke has a big D," flash across the screen. Another female author agreed that the song was rapey and defended the use of the term in a piece for the Wall Street Journal. The word rapey has become a popular word among young third-wave feminists, she wrote. Some people have criticized the use of the word, claiming that it trivializes sexual assault. I disagree. I find the term very useful. I like to think of the word as the adjectival form of rape culture. It's hard to argue that Blurred Lines, which achieved the longest run at number one on Billboard since the early 1990s, does not have clear violent undertones. The lyrics include lines like, "Tried to domesticate you, but you're an animal," and "Good girl, I know you want it," and "I'll give you something big enough to tear your expletive in two," and "He don't smack that expletive and pull your hair for you." Some music critics brushed the song off as one among many problematic pop songs with lyrics that degrade women and imply non-consensual or violent sex, but most feminist writers and websites expressed outrage. One piece on XO Jane featured pictures of rape victims holding up signs displaying words their rapists had said to them, some of them verbatim lines from Thick's song. Feminists' reaction to Thick's lyrics betrayed the fact that people, women especially, still intuit that, when it comes to sexuality, not every choice is okay. So when Blurred Lines video star Radikowski called herself a feminist, she unleashed a liberal feminist panic. Over the course of decades, the word feminism had been stripped of any meaning, as it was used to justify even the most demeaning behavior, as long as choice was somehow, somewhere involved. This left today's feminists, as I said on Acculturated, stuck between a rock and a stripper pole when it came to stars of rapey, pornographic videos claiming the label. The smash success of Thick's song revealed the uglier side of Hollywood. Despite all the talk about empowering women and fostering gender equity, misogyny sells, and Hollywood's head honchos and stars, plenty of women included, aren't afraid to cash in. Few episodes illustrate this better than the legal battle that developed between one of the music industry's most influential producers, Dr. Luke, and a young female singer who accused him of rape, Kesha. Dr. Luke, or Lucas Sebastian Gottwald, is a Grammy-nominated guitarist and producer behind many of today's biggest hits. He specializes in music for young women, with an ironic subspecialty in girl power anthems like Since You've Been Gone by Kelly Clarkson, Circus by Britney Spears, Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, and Roar by Katy Perry. Roar was the campaign anthem for Alison Lundergan Grimes, whose attempt to unseat Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was a spectacular failure. Katy Perry repeatedly performed it on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton. Clinton is a fan of Perry, and also considers Kim Kardashian to be inspirational. At one Iowa event, Perry wore multiple outfits with the Hillary for President logo and even sported Hillary-themed nails. As it turned out, Hillary Clinton's campaign was also a spectacular failure. But all the girl power in Hollywood was no help to Kesha, who, we have seen, filed a 2014 lawsuit against Dr. Luke, alleging he had drugged and raped her. Her description of waking up naked in his bed with no memory of how she got there is eerily reminiscent of lyrics that Dr. Luke himself wrote from the song Last Friday Night. There's a stranger in my bed. There's a pounding in my head. Is this a hickey or a bruise? The singer? Hillary Clinton's Hollywood liaison to women, Katy Perry. Kesha's battle against Dr. Luke garnered major media attention and lots of support from other young women. Fellow Sony star Adele dedicated her Brit Award to the embattled singer, and Taylor Swift donated $250,000 for her legal bills. As the hashtag #FreeKesha went viral, other female celebs like Lady Gaga offered their support over Twitter. There are people all over the world who love you, at Kesha Rose. And I can say truly I am in awe of your bravery, said Gaga, in a tweet liked by over 100,000 Twitter users. The way Kesha's legal drama unfolded horrified many. Sony sided with Dr. Luke in the case, refusing to release Kesha from her contract and insisting that she continue to work under her alleged rapist, despite Kesha's claim that he had threatened to destroy her music career if she told anyone about the rape. As one article for Bust magazine noted, the music industry gave Kesha the cold shoulder, and in pushing the singer out of the music world, sent a warning to all young women in the music business to keep their mouths shut if they want to continue with their careers. It was the ultimate blow to Hollywood's new claim to be feminist. When Dr. Luke filed suit in New York claiming that Kesha had committed defamation and violated her contract, Kesha filed a counterclaim accusing him of gender-based hate crimes. But as we have already seen, the judge threw out her suit, explaining that rape is not always a gender-motivated hate crime. To get on with her contract, the judge wrote, was the commercially reasonable thing to do. A wave of starlet stories of sexual abuse followed in the wake of Kesha's story. Thandi Newton revealed that early in her career, a major Hollywood director had sexually abused her in an audition. Years later, she was stunned to learn that the director had actually shown a film of the incident to friends at poker parties at his house. Rose McGowan came out as having been raped by a Hollywood executive she was still too afraid to name. All this while Hollywood was reeling from the revelations that family man Bill Cosby had been systematically raping women throughout his career. And so Hollywood's feminism comes full circle. Any choices women make, under who knows what kind of pressure from male producers and record label executives, must be afforded the feminist label, including giving voice to lyrics that downplay the seriousness of violent or potentially non-consensual sex. But the same women, the very stars who enrich the likes of Dr. Luke by performing music that raises serious ethical questions about the treatment of women, find themselves powerless and are written off by those with actual power. So women in feminist Hollywood have their own voice, just as long as they are using it to sexify rape music. Andy Zeisler summed the paradox up in a piece for The Guardian entitled, Music Business Feminism is Little More Than Branding. Just ask Kesha. Because while it's easy to throw the label feminist into a fizzy mix of other identifying descriptors, it's a lot harder to carve out a space for ongoing norm-shifting progress in an industry that has been shaped by and steeped in inequality, stereotyping, and ambient discrimination. A place where groundbreaking performers from Joni Mitchell to Kathleen Hanna to Nicki Minaj have been defined less by their musical or vocal skills than by their looks and whom they were sleeping with. A place where female musicians have their work diminished by or in favor of their male collaborators, and, most definitely, a place where female musicians are expected to go along to get along. Inspirational but overbroad statements about empowerment and girl power become exclusively personal, acts of independent saleswomanship that manifest as branding rather than action. Despite all the power talk, Zeisler points out, few women are in actual positions of power in the music business. Women make up less than 5% of recognized record producers. According to the Huffington Post, Creative and Cultural Skills report that the gender divide across all music industry-related jobs is 67.8% male to 32.2% female. PRS for Music report that their membership of over 95,000 songwriters and composers is only 13% female. AIM's 2012 membership survey revealed that only 15% of label members are majority owned by women. Only 15 people on the 2015 Billboard Power 100 list were female. And a chart in Time magazine showed that the professional category of musicians, singers, and related had one of the lowest percentages of women in the field as compared with other professions, with less than 1/4 of the field being female. Only 5 industries were more male-dominated, examples including dishwashers and cleaners of vehicles and equipment. Television and film have similar gender equity woes. The situation is so bad, in fact, that there have been recent calls for the ACLU to get involved and investigate sex discrimination throughout the industry. To quote Salon, Hollywood is a cesspool of misogyny and racism. Bring on the lawsuits. As one higher up at the ACLU told the New York Times, women directors aren't working on an even playing field and aren't getting a fair opportunity to succeed. Gender discrimination is illegal. And really, Hollywood doesn't get this free pass when it comes to civil rights and gender discrimination. The Times cites a number of studies finding that in the last 12 years, only 4% of the top-grossing movies were directed by women, and in 2013 and 2014, less than 2% were. In those same years, women directed only 14% of television shows. There is basically no end to the articles and exposés about misogyny in Hollywood. Casting whores. One of the ACLU's complaints about sexism in Hollywood is rampant and overt sex stereotyping. To take just one example, a casting agency for a film produced by Quentin Tarantino placed an ad on Facebook beginning, "Casting whores for Quentin Tarantino project." The ad was deleted, but not before it was captured in a screen grab. Casting, May 27 at 3:49 p.m. Casting whores for Quentin Tarantino project. Caucasian, non-union females, ages 18 to 35. Western film shoots June 21st through 25th in Los Angeles. No highlights, natural eyebrows, natural breasts, natural hair color to be true to the period. Dress size 2 to 8. Please send photo, including sizes, to, and write whore in the subject line. If you are in the database, you may comment with your name below and I will use your database profile to submit to the director. Thanks. Unsurprisingly, Tarantino was widely slammed for the ad. To quote one feminist blog, putting a casting call out for or including women in your script with the description of whores is not okay. Nor is asking actresses to submit their photos and information for consideration with the subject line, whore. Aside from the fact that there are better words to use if one is looking to cast women who work in the sex industry, this description is actually a typical example of Hollywood sexism, particularly as it pertains to roles for women. Forget for a moment that referring to prostitution as the sex industry legitimizes using women. This ad is coming from the same industry that gave us Pretty Woman, the cult classic starring Julia Roberts and Richard Gere that glamorizes prostitution, making it look like a gateway to romance, replete with a happy ending and a balcony set reunion scene straight out of Romeo and Juliet. According to Mental Floss, Pretty Woman is the fourth highest grossing romantic comedy of all time. It's also categorized as a Cinderella complex movie. In that category, it comes in number 2, just behind My Big Fat Greek Wedding. The term Cinderella complex was coined by feminist Colette Dowling in her 1981 book, The Cinderella Complex, Women's Hidden Fear of Independence. Dowling, who boasts about leaving her husband, determined after much study of the psychological differences between the sexes that women are brought up to depend on a man and to feel naked and frightened without one. We have been taught to believe that as females we cannot stand alone, that we are too fragile, too delicate, too needful of protection. So that now, in these enlightened days, when so much has become possible, unresolved emotional issues often hold us back. We are, apparently, plagued by an unconscious desire to be taken care of by another. Refer back to Exhibit A, Sofia Vergara, the traitor to her sex who horrified the feminists by standing on a pedestal and describing her husband as supporting and saying, "I don't see anything bad with getting help from somebody that loves you and treats you well." I guess Julia Roberts should have stayed a prostitute. Dumbing dads down. Not all of Hollywood's sex-based animosity is directed at women. A study entitled Daddies or Dummies, conducted at Brigham Young University, concluded that the media may not only be portraying fathers negatively, but actually teaching youth to disrespect and disregard their dads. The study found that 40% of fatherly behavior on popular tween shows could be labeled buffoonery, and that half of on-screen responses of children to their fathers are negative behaviors like eye-rolling or walking away. As Naomi Schaefer Riley wrote, father humor is nothing new in movies and TV, but now it's happening at a time when a man's role in the home is more uncertain than ever. Today's sitcoms, she writes, often show dads trying to act like mothers have traditionally and failing miserably. And even though today's feminists go out of their way to claim that being a strong woman doesn't mean you have to hate men, as Lena Dunham put it, feminism doesn't mean you want to, like, take a stake and kill all the men and create your own planet. Masculinity is increasingly a source of scandal on screen. Just take Vanity Fair's reaction to the latest Captain America movie. Joanna Robinson opined in its pages that the heterosexual virility of the movie's male figures is the one flaw in the otherwise great flick. Captain America: Civil War is a recent addition to the Avengers series, based on the Marvel comic books, which are basically muscles, violence, and masculine virility served up raw, cartoon strip style. Hyper-male superhero and action figure movies have long been a Hollywood specialty. The top 10 grossing film franchises of all time include the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Star Wars, Batman, James Bond, X-Men, Spider-Man, and Shrek. Action heroes, superheroes, Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, more action heroes, and a giant green ogre. Calls for more female representation in the action figure universe ultimately began to materialize, but on-screen action heroines, for the most part, are highly sexualized and violent. Either they behave like men in peak moments of heterosexual virility, or they look like the fulfillment of the most debased male fantasy. Take, for example, Angelina Jolie in the 2005 blockbuster Mr. and Mrs. Smith, in which she doubled as blasé wife and sexy spy. She spends most of the movie violating Dunham's don't kill the men principle by trying to kill her own husband, all while, to use Russell Scott Smith's phrasing for the New York Post, exploiting her sexuality for shock value. Perhaps no one is as open about exploiting female sexuality as Axel Alonso, the editor-in-chief for Marvel Comics, whose movie empire takes the number one spot on the list of highest-grossing franchises in history. In a stunning interview with The Telegraph, Alonso says, "It's impossible not to sexualize female characters." When pressed about the fact that almost half of comic book readers are females, he responded, "We believe there's an audience of women out there who are hungry for this, and we want to make sure they get it. This is affirmative action. This is capitalism." And he insists that sexualizing female protagonists is essential. "I won't say we won't do sexy female characters. That's preposterous and ridiculous. I want to make sure I have books like Ms. Marvel and Black Widow that I'm proud about and could give to my daughter. But at the same time, I don't want to be the PC police and say you can't be naughty, you can't be fun." He openly affirms the obvious when he says, "I don't think men are as sexualized as women." Although Alonso sounded like Hugh Hefner, his female interviewer closes the piece on a bland note. Even though Marvel won't stop fully sexualizing female characters, it's good news that they are still working on diversity. Cover boy? There is no denying Hollywood's influence in the cultural conversation. It has a lot to say, and gives us a lot to talk about when it comes to sex difference and that ever-elusive quest for gender equity. Girls today grow up on a steady diet of famous self-professed feminists like Miley Cyrus, Taylor Swift, and Queen Bey. Lena Dunham recently finished producing a documentary for HBO called Suited, which, according to USA Today, explores the complexities of gender identity through the prism of Bindle and Keep, a Brooklyn tailor specializing in suits designed for gender nonconforming clientele. The film documents the personal stories of people who have transitioned, are transitioning, or choose not to identify themselves by he or she pronouns, but share common desires for inclusivity and body confidence. But what about body confidence for the rest of us? Are we supposed to feel comfortable in our own skin as men and women? Not if you listen to Hollywood, where fathers are incompetent and ridiculous, masculinity is offensive, and feminine elegance and appreciation for men's contributions are pilloried, while hypersexualized women who celebrate domestic violence are supposed to be empowered. Hollywood's ideal woman is forced into a mold cast by the most depraved male fantasy and then slapped with a label feminist. The architects of this ugly feminism then tell women everywhere it's their job to support it. We have an obligation to celebrate any choice women make. All hail Kim Kardashian, who practically invented the term naked selfie, as long as it's not the choice to celebrate motherhood, traditional femininity, or any other authentic expression of our female selves. To Hollywood, sex is only real when they want it to be. It's merely a construct when Bruce Jenner becomes Caitlyn and Miley Cyrus decides that she is neither boy nor girl. It's up for debate when makeup line CoverGirl unveils that its newest model is a biological man. Meet CoverGirl's first cover boy, read the CNN.com headline touting the cosmetics company's bold move of replacing a woman with a man for the first time to advertise products for women. But when Chrissy Teigen picks a female embryo out of a lab dish, sex is real and matters, and we must all validate the significance of her choice. And then again, sex is just a plaything, as are the women who put their sexuality at the service of the entertainment industry. Even a cursory look at how it's all working out for Hollywood's women, and for the everyday women who consume what Hollywood produces, makes it clear that women have gotten the short end of Hollywood's gender equity stick. Chapter 7. The Sexual Devolution. Women's liberation calls it enslavement, but the real truth about the sexual revolution is that it has made of sex an almost chaotically limitless and therefore unmanageable realm in the life of women. Midge Dector. It was one of the last weeks of my senior year at Tufts, and a group of us were standing in a circle talking. One female student, a friend of a friend, was staring at her feet as the rest of us chatted. I couldn't figure out what was wrong, but she seemed upset, her face slowly darkening to crimson. After a few minutes, a couple of the guys said goodbye and walked away. I leaned over and asked, "Are you okay?" She looked up at me and glanced at the back of one of the guys. "I gave him oral sex last night," she replied, "and today he wouldn't even look at me." I present to you the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution was like a hydrogen bomb taken to human sexuality. Though it was launched by the Americans coming of age in the 1950s and 60s, subsequent generations such as my own are still living in a cloud of nuclear fallout. Our moral landscape is like the bombed-out cities after the world wars, and we are like citizens left behind to sort through the debris. To understand why we are where we are today, living in a world where suggesting the sexes are different is a national scandal, a world where the moral